to go French one time.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Charlotte Line. This is Dr. John Stamey, live to you from sunny, beautiful Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. We're going to have a great show tonight, especially because of these two guys. First of all, from Studio G, Greenville, South Carolina, Zach Beechler. Zach, how are you doing tonight?
I'm tired but excited to talk about the racing tonight, as always.
Well, that's great. We're glad to have you here. And from Des Moines, Iowa, in the middle of the universe, right, Brady? It's Brady Van Sickle. How are you doing tonight, Brady?
Oh, doing good today. You know, it's just a Tuesday, debate night Tuesday, but I'd rather be talking about racing than watching two geriatric dementia-riddled guys talk about our future. So, yeah, I'm really sick of Jeff being here tonight, Doc John.
All righty. Well, Zach, what's going on in the racing world? Tell us.
Well, in the racing world, we were just in Viva Las Vegas, and NASCAR announces some big changes to the schedule and possible rumors to the schedule. And earlier today, seven-time champion crew chief Chad Knaus says he'll be stepping around from being a crew chief and being the VP of operations, from what I read, to run Hendrick Motorsports. It's been a crazy. Last week we talked about a lot of different news, and ever since, you know, that show, there hasn't been a whole lot of news. There's been kind of small things here and there. This driver's doing this, that driver's doing that. I thought, okay, we're not going to get much for news. And then out of nowhere, oh yeah, we're going to drop like three big stories today, including the possibility of Bristol going to be covered in dirt yet again, but not for dirt cars, but for NASCAR Cup car stories.
Yeah, and you and I were talking about this earlier today, and I'm really kind of torn, I guess is the best way I can think to put it. I to me, it just seems like a move that just screams of desperation. And of a track like Bristol, I feel like a track that produces routinely decent races and always is known for putting on a good show shouldn't have to, you know, resort to cheap tricks and pony gimmicks just to try and bring in a crowd. But for some reason, that spring event, the daytime race every March or April, just has not been a good ticket holder these last few years. Some people point to, you know, maybe weather being a factor in there, because the March race, it seems like the last 5 years has always been rained out, so that could be a factor. Other people just simply put it that it's just not the same event that the night race is in the fall, which I could see that. You know, the nighttime air is just a different atmosphere. It's only electric, and I could see that argument. But when you think back on NASCAR's history and just the amount of races that were run at Bristol at the daytime, it just seems like such a cornerstone to the sport that I just feel like Bristol's not the problem. You know, if we want to add a dirt track, great, you know, but why does it have to come at the sacrifice of Bristol? Like, that's just kind of, I guess, my whole thing with it. And plus, I also do not know how they're going to pull off a dirt race with the current Cup car. Them motherfuckers are low, dirt nasty low. There's like a Hoover vacuum going around a dirt mile at Bristol. The other thing, Bristol is banked to shit. How are they going to keep the cars up on the banking, let alone, you know, navigate how narrow Bristol is generally? Because when you think like, oh, it's going to be easy, the trucks, they race the dirt at Eldora. We can do it. But Eldora is so wide, so sweeping. Like, there's so much room there. Like, if you look at the corner, you can just dive bomb it. It's just so vast out there. But Bristol, my guys, like, it is narrow. It's Cereal Bowl as Cereal Bowl comes. So that's been my whole, like, headspace this entire time thinking about the possibility of it. But on the other hand, we're talking dirt racing at Bristol. It's going to be a shit show. So, of course, my messy ass is signed up for this, because how could I miss what is going to be an absolute fantastic shit show in the making? Like, I'm all there for it. So that's kind of where I'm at on this, Zach. I really just don't know how to feel about that news.
Well, and to put a couple things in perspective, one, NASCAR has not announced this. This has been some rumors that's been circulating from trusted sources that have made have kind of broke stories or said stories, so there's no confirmation of this. Second, if NASCAR were to do a dirt race at Bristol, more than likely it wouldn't just be for the Cup cars. It would possibly be for even the Xfinity cars, but they would also do stuff like wind sprint cars or dirt late models, which they have done in the past. And in fact, I sent Brady a couple clips to watch of that stuff that happened. And honestly, I'm kind of for it. It's weird. I'm not normally for like big swings like this when we have facilities that are already built for racing like this, Eldora being a keen example. The NASCAR Gander Outdoor Series goes and races there, obviously. But this is something that, as a kid, I remember hearing about Bristol running a dirt and then being like, I don't think that's right. And being old enough now to see this stuff and to see it, like, oh my God, they really did. To me, it's something I would love to see again. Now, if it does happen that NASCAR doesn't do it, but they still do, you know, dirt racing, I might just drive up there to go see some dirt racing because Bristol's only about 4 hours away and I'd love to go see some dirt action. But to me, I think it's something that NASCAR wants to venture out to do more of what fans have been wanting, which is some dirt action, which I can't blame them. I'm not the biggest dirt guy, as Brady knows, but I do enjoy it a lot. I still go to races if I have the ability to, or if I know people are going to kind of just hang out and have fun with it. So I'm kind of for it in the sense that it's something that NASCAR wants to try. Cool, let's give it a shot. But then there's a side of me that I say quite a bit, and Brady knows this. We already have facilities, dirt facilities that NASCAR runs at, you know, even though it's only one, Eldora, and also the dirt ring at Las Vegas Motor Speedway, which obviously is not built for Cup cars or any like that, or even the trucks. The K&N series, which is now the ARCA East and West series, you know, has done a couple races there, and it's a fantastic race, do not get me wrong, but it's a double-sided thing for me. I love the idea. I love Bristol. Seeing cars run on the dirt, I'd love to see. Now, to go with you, Brady, the biggest factor that I heard you talk about was how low the cars are. And to me, I see them running possibly a Martinsville package, because Martinsville, you don't have to have the car that low because you aren't really getting that much aerodynamics and or anything out of it. So if you look at some Martinsville practices and stuff, yeah, they kind of do slam down to the ground, but a lot of times that's during qualifying runs, and they still have a few inches of clearance. And then if you take the splitter off, which is about an inch to an inch and a half, that still leaves about 3 inches, and the NASCAR would probably give them new springs and new shocks for the race because of that. So it still is going to be a shit show, but you're not just going to see, you know, Kyle Busch go into turn one and just slam the nose into the ground out of nowhere. He'll probably have a few inches of clearance, unless he's just like, nah, I want the front end glued to the floor.
Well, yeah, you bring up a good point that they'll probably more than likely have to bring in some sort of special package or do something different with the springs to get those cars up off the track just a little bit. But it still is going to be a whole other package that these teams and crews have to really work around, and I just don't see the benefit for a one-off race. Granted, this could maybe open the door for maybe NASCAR toying around the idea of bringing back dirt, being a part of the staple, being a part of the well-rounded NASCAR driver, a NASCAR champion worthy of the NASCAR crown. I don't know if that's part of the long-term plan, just spitballing here, but it could be a way that maybe they're looking at testing the grounds with a track like Bristol that's already established, already led by the fans, to see if maybe this is something that they can toy around with in the future. We've already heard them, you know, being very open to things like street courses, being things like more road courses, more short tracks. So if they're looking at street courses, why not looking at maybe adding some dirt tracks? So it'll be really intriguing to see where they take this from here.
I think one thing I would add to it is, you know, if they do Bristol for some reason, which is possible, obviously it's been done before and they haven't run there, but Bristol has put down a ton of dirt to do this. I would love to see them go to Knoxville. I mean, that's a track that, Brady, you've been to several times. You really enjoy it, as you've told me. And it's a fantastic facility, and you have people like, you know, Kyle Larson, Scott Blomquist, you know, just about any dirt guy has raced up there. that would be a cool event to go see, you know, Scott or you know, any of those big dirt guys. Brady, you could name off a couple because I got nothing. But it would be cool to see them do a big, come in with some money with maybe Premium Motorsports or Rick Ware Racing and be like, yeah, I want to do, you know, Knoxville. And that would be awesome to see.
Well, and just with that, Knoxville, like, is a very well-established dirt track. It's where the Sprint Car Nationals are held, the most prestigious, you know, dirt track event in the country. So to me, you know, maybe I'm a little biased here, but it seems like a track like that should warrant, you know, a green light for a possible NASCAR date ahead of just pouring an ass ton of dirt all over the banks of Bristol. Like that, I mean, economically, like, how is that feasible? A, but B, you know, I don't know. Like, it just seems like a whole bunch of effort when there are so many other facilities that could host this event. Like, it just seems like, why are we doing this? We are making these rules, man. Like, why would we do this to ourselves?
Warranted, you know, it has been something they've done before, and it gives them the opportunity to run, you know, late models, and when sprint cars, even 360 cars, or even doing, you know, a little four banger, $1,000 to win race. So it's not just for the one race event. And if it can be done logistically that way, then it does make sense. But either way, adding dirt to the Cup Series, by the way, the first time that NASCAR had been back dirt racing was in the Truck Series. I believe it was 2013, where Austin Dillon won the 2013. Yes, I got my year right. Where Austin Dillon won the inaugural Mud Midsummer Classic, and I got to tell you what, that was the first time, I believe, since 1970 that we had run on dirt. And the fact that they might do a huge jump to let, you know, the Cup guys do it before they even try it with the Xfinity cars, it's kind of interesting, and I love the idea. Just the fact that we might get dirt in the Cup Series again is the one thing I'm looking forward to.
Oh, yeah, no, for the purest fans out there, this is the best news you could possibly hope to hear. The return to our roots, bringing some dirt action back to the Cup Series. Like Zach said, not seen since the 70s. I believe it was the Nashville Fairgrounds, maybe that was the, no, not Nashville. That's just on my brain because that's what every Dale Earnhardt Jr. fan is talking about right now. No, it was the Raleigh Fairgrounds. There we go, Raleigh, North Carolina Fairgrounds. That was the last NASCAR track to host a dirt event back all the way. I believe it was just straight up 1970, but it might have been like 72 or something. And
I believe
so
it was I think it was 71 at the latest.
That sounds about right. But regardless, this would be a huge move, especially with some of the different proposals that we've seen tossed around for different venues and how NASCAR is trying to, you know, keep one toe in the past but modernize the sport in a big way. Throwing a race back to the dirt would be a hell of a way to keep toe firmly planted by respecting the roots, the history of the sport, but still, you know, giving a, kind of like a blessing per se for the vast, you know, modernization and upgrades that NASCAR is trying to do to a lot of its facilities, and maybe even the possibility of adding a street course, which would be completely foreign, minus a few special events here and there in the history of NASCAR for the sport in general. So it'd be a nice way to kind of counterbalance those scales as we're heading into some very, very uncharted but very new and exciting waters here in the next couple of years.
And the big thing is the schedule change. And you know, nothing has been announced on what the schedule actually looks like. All we hear are tidbits coming here and there. And two of them that we said right at the beginning were Chicagoland and Kentucky will not host Cup events next year. And there's – I kind of said this. I think I probably said it with you, Brady. With Chicagoland, I feel like it's a track that it's ho-hum to me. You know, yes, there's been some good events. Yes, there's been some great stuff like the slide job with the Kyle and Kyle show that Dale Earnhardt Jr. kind of, you know, I don't want to say trademarked, but he made it work somehow. But I just think back to, you know, Auto Club having such amazing finishes in the past 5 years. And with Chicagoland, I can't say the same thing. So I'm not surprised that this is happening. They still will hold some events, but none of them are in the Cup Series. I think it's going to be only ARCA stuff.
Which, I mean, you said it right there perfectly, Zach. It's a shame, but, I mean, with the direction the sport's heading and with the clamoring of the fans the last few years, NASCAR made the right call. I really hate that because of the mile-and-a-half tracks on the schedule. I think that Chicagoland might be one of the more entertaining ones, so it really pains me that we have to sacrifice entertainment, but I'm glad that at least the fans are being heard. There's just way too many of these mile-and-a-half tracks, and that's not what people tune into the sport for. They tune into close, beating and banging racing. And while you'll get that on occasion, like with Sly Job or with some of the great finishes we've had in the last couple of years, you know, that kind of entertainment is just not sustainable and not, you know, prevalent on a mile and a half course. And a course like Chicagoland in particular, you know, it's going to be hard to say goodbye when the track's really at its peak and really was hitting its stride. But for a lot of fans out there, we got to remember this track is old. It's got a really aged surface. And so the time is ticking on when it's going to have to go through a repave. And as we've seen with so many mile and a half tracks recently, repaved races, you know, they're terrible. It just takes so much time to get that track, you know, massaged in, worked in, get the grooves just right. And you just can't do that with a brand new surface. It takes some, you know, natural weathering and some passage of time. And unfortunately for a track like Chicagoland, where the market just isn't supporting it, the fan attendance just keeps slipping year and year, it does not have that time that it needs to let a new surface, you know, curate. So, unfortunately, it's just the drumbeat of time, you know, the sound beats of a modern era. But for any NASCAR fan, this is just kind of old hat. Like, this feels very, very much similar to some big moves that went on in 1996, when that was the year that they dropped North Wilkesboro officially from the schedule for the 1997 season, ahead of the brand spanking new Texas Motor Speedway and what was it, Auto Club, I think, was the other one that opened in 97. And, yeah, so, and already those two tracks that were the big, you know, rollout back in 96 when we had something similar to this, they're going to be very much in different capacities going forward. Texas losing one of its points dates is the rumors that we're all hearing to Circuit of the Americas to instead get the All-Star race as a consolation prize. And then in 2022, the Auto Club Speedway is going to shrink down from a two-mile D-shaped oval to a paper-clipped, high-banked half-mile. So, you know, times are changing, and that's just one of the things that's always accompanying the sport, you know, and that's one of the things that's exciting about the sport. Change is exciting. It's scary. You know, you want it to work out. There's a possibility that it might not, but you can't deny that it's exciting to see new things on the horizon, especially when they have the possibility to really invigorate the sport unlike anything that's ever come before it.
Now, I do think it's weird because of the fact that, you know, we are losing Auto Club, and you have a Chicagoland, which is a, you know, it is a great facility for the most part. I still hold some bias because that's where I proposed to my ex-fiance, and that obviously worked out really well. But it's one of those things where I feel like taking that track away, especially in the Midwest market, which is one of the more booming markets for NASCAR still, you know, even though attendance isn't the best, you look at a lot of races, you know, with fan interaction and fan engagement, the Midwest tends to be a lot better than most other tracks. You know, I see Martinsville, you know, yeah, they have a great thing going for them, but engagement with the fans and, you know, the what they have is not there. When you see what they are able to do at Bristol, it's the same kind of deal. Even Charlotte, you know, the big thing for Charlotte is the 600. And even now with the Roval, it has changed. But before then, the fall event race wasn't, you know, there wasn't much fan interaction. And that's what these Midwest tracks have that keeps them going and keeps a lot of fans coming back, is the fact that, yeah, this is a badass track that has a lot of interaction. I can even remember fans going to the track just to go to the track. It wasn't to go to the race. It was to go to, you know, see the drivers outside the track gate, to go, you know, interact with people, see friends, hang out, buy some souvenirs. Oh, cool, I could go get this or that. So it's kind of a bad thing. I do like that they're, you know, taking steps back away from doing all these mile and a half tracks. But I feel like if you're going to take, you know, Chicagoland away, I would say bring it back after 2021 because of the fact that we are losing Auto Club. And that surface is really good because of the fact that there is the really harsh winters and the really hard rains and everything in the Midwest that go through Illinois, as, you know, me and you both have experienced, that it's a great surface to race on. And it would just be a shame for it to go to waste, essentially.
You know, the one counterpoint I would offer to that, though, is while it really pains me that we're going to lose such a very crucial race, and what you pointed out is a very high hopping in, you know, important market for NASCAR, there are still so many tracks in this area that I don't think the impact is going to be near as widespread. And honestly, I think it could only help maybe bolster some of the other tracks in the area. Tracks that come to mind like Gateway, which I think many in the industry are heavily looking at as NASCAR's next place they're looking at possibly hosting an event, kind of like IndyCar, and that's going to be right there in Wisconsin, so not too far away from where the Chicagoland Speedway is at, so it could fill that void there. Also, places like Kansas and Michigan are close enough by that maybe they can take on some of those speeders by, you know, wooing some of those Illinois fans over, but really what I kind of like what I'm hearing is with the removal of, you know, some of these mile and a half, like we're really going to see, honestly, a true balance of types of tracks on the schedule minus the super speedways, Talladega and Daytona. Because what I'm hearing is a lot of the rumors, a lot of these dates that they're slashing and giving up aren't going to a whole bunch of short tracks. And it seems like more road courses are being added to the schedule next year with, everything from the Indianapolis road course to Road America to the Daytona road course, even being thrown out there as possible situations where we could end up next year seeing racing, even a street course like we talked about last week on our podcast in Nashville. And to me, that is super exciting from a competition standpoint. For years, we've proudly, you know, bore the label as being the top echelon of motorsports in America. And for the longest time, there really wasn't a challenge to that. You know, with the IRL split with CART in the 90s, IndyCar kind of really fell on some hard times. But these last few years, IndyCar stepped up to a model that's really kind of given us a challenge for that moniker that we wear so proudly. And by diversifying our schedule, really forcing our drivers to showcase their driving ability by racing on short tracks, big super speedways, intermediate tracks, a whole hefty road courses, and having them be equally balanced out so you have to be equally good on all disciplines to be considered a champion of our sport, I think that's really going to add so much weight behind the title of NASCAR Cup Series champion. Granted, I still don't like a lot of the playoff, you know, gimmicks and hijinks because I really feel like it makes too much of it kind of chancy and it really kind of takes away from that competition, but that's a whole other discussion for another day. But if you really, really want to test these drivers, really force them to showcase their mettle on all disciplines of racing, that is what truly separates the good drivers from the great drivers. And by doing this, NASCAR is just going to further, you know, cement that argument that if you are going to be a top racing driver and you are going to race in the United States of America, you are going to race in NASCAR, because that is where the best of the best, that is where the greatest of the greats cut their teeth and their racing and show their racing strength, is in the National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing, not IndyCar, not any sprint car or Winged Outlaw or anything like that. It's in NASCAR. And you do that by having these drivers really put their tests on the line.
NASCAR. Yeah. NASCAR. Yeah, go for it. Yeah, I mean, that's, you're absolutely right. And, you know, NASCAR itself has not always been on road courses, ovals. A lot of stuff was on road courses and even dirt, which brings back to, you know, kind of earlier, like I said. Now, to me, I'm looking forward to what we're going to be able to do because of the fact of the 2021 changes. The big thing that I think a lot of people will be looking forward as well is the fact that we're going to have those opportunities to have something a lot different, you know, and even have opportunities to see maybe even see a ringer come out every so often. Maybe like, you know, Jordan Taylor, who runs for the factory Corvette team in the U.S. Le Mans Series. See him come out. Maybe even see Alonso Fernando Alonso from F1. You know, he may be like, oh, you guys are running this track? I'd love to run that track. I don't have an F1 race that weekend. Let me fly over to the States and race. And it gives opportunity for a lot of, I don't want to call them ringers, but people who, you know, might have the love for racing and want to try NASCAR to come over and do a road course or even a street course because that's what they're comfortable with. You know, an F1 does a lot of street courses. IndyCar does a lot of street courses, as well as the American Le Mans Series does a lot of street courses. It'd be fun to see. So I'm looking forward to it. I want to see the schedule done right now because I need it. I need the schedule done right now. Right now, I want to see it.
Honestly, there's just so much we've got to know. I got to know, but that's what makes it exciting. That's what makes this whole time of year super, you know, just full of wonderment. It's like Christmas. You just never know what you're going to open underneath the tree next. And I love it for that reason, but that's not the only bit of news though, Zach. We've had the ability to munch on a lot of different rotations and, you know, silly season announcements. We've, of course, had the big announcement last week with Michael Jordan joining the sport to form a team with Bubba Wallace and Denny Hamlin. Just the earth-shattering news that was. Ross Chastain coming up to the Cup Series. But now we had a big announcement today. You were talking to me just about here just a little bit ago. Hendrick Motorsports announced a huge change. They're trying to rebuild and kind of, you know, put their eyes firmly on the future. They've got a bunch of young talent, a bunch of young drivers, and they're really trying to find a good, you know, a good kind of rudder, you know, put down in the water, really guide the ship in the right direction. They're actively trying to find, you know, a veteran presence to replace the outgoing Jimmy Johnson to keep the keep a nice steady hand, you know, development-wise for the driver's side firmly in place. But now they announced that Chad Knaus will be moving into an executive VP role of competition to really help strengthen the competition side of the organization and really offer Chad's championship, you know, know-how, his extreme technical intellect to the entire organization as a whole, rather than having him crew chief just one of the individual teams, which means that the 7-time champion, 82 cup race winner, Chad Knaus will call his final race in just 6 more events, which is kind of sad, you know, all things considered. He's been such a staple to the sport, but, you know, that's just the nature of the beast. You know, progress is progress. We got to keep moving forward, and this is the perfect role for Chad Knaus to move into. He reminds me a lot of Doug Ducharte, who kind of guided Hendrick through the glory days in the 90s, really helped the organization find the technical wherewithal to keep them one step above the competition. And I feel like putting Chad in that position and just the knowledge and just how meticulous he is, it can only just help bolster that program, which has seen a lot of increase in performance this year with this brand new Camaro body. So that could really help lay the groundwork for them to keep building on it, maybe catching up to Ford and Toyota rivals here hopefully soon.
It definitely is something crazy to hear the fact that Chad Knaus, the guy who won 7 championships, has only worked as a crew chief for 2 drivers in his career, one of them being a legend, and we can say that because that's what Jimmy Johnson is, and he will be forever, because winning 7 championships, you can't be called a legend without that, because we have Richard Petty and Dale Earnhardt, who are legends, but they didn't win their 7 championships with the same crew chiefs. They were all different crew chiefs. Chad Knaus, 7-time champion in the Cup Series with Jimmy Johnson, and moving up to this, it's not really a huge surprise to see that Chad's going to be taking a role like this, because Chad does love racing and everything. But it's funny to see it's not funny, it's odd to see him step down, you know, with William at the wheel. Especially with only having 1 win. But again, I'm not someone who can say what's good or what's bad. I'm very happy for Chad because, you know, again, winning 7 championships, 84 races, and having that staff behind you will just propel your career no matter what. Obviously, he's staying with Hendrick Motorsports, which is a great thing, not just for him, but for Hendrick Motorsports itself, because they love Chad, and Chad knows what he's doing, obviously. So it's going to be a great thing to see, but it will be odd to not see him at the track, or at least hear him on the radio. It kind of reminds me of Kurt Busch's crew chief when he won the 500 after that year. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but that year Tony Gibson. You're right. Thank you. He retired from being a full-time crew chief to being just a, you know, guy that works at Stewart Haas full-time. And, you know, seeing crew chiefs step down is a normal thing, and to see them stay in the sport is going to be great, and especially to see what they're going to be able to do for their own competition.
Oh, yeah, and plus, I don't feel like we're not going to not see Chad Knauss. He's had a very distinct presence with the Fox broadcast team, doing stuff with, like, Race Hub, and even doing a couple of broadcasts. So I feel like this honestly might open the door for him to balance out his life and maybe – up his TV responsibilities, you know, utilize this new role with Hendrick Motorsports to free up his weekends to where maybe he can step into the booth more often. So I don't think this will be the end of us seeing Chad Knauss by any stretch of the imagination. But I can't imagine that this is probably coming on the heels of him becoming a new father. Him and his wife just recently welcomed a baby, I believe, girl, just about a year, maybe a year and a half ago, time's a construct, who knows at this point. And for a guy like Chad Knauss, where everything was about the race car, everything was about the competition, about the sport, having this completely new chapter in his life is probably giving him new perspective. And it really did not come as a shock to me that he was going to take more of a administrative role with the company. He's definitely earned an administrative role with the company for everything he's brought Hendrick Motorsports over the years. I just think it's going to be a great, you know, a great result for everyone going forward. It's really going to help bolster everyone in the organization. And I just hope that it gives Chad Knauss the balance he's looking for, maybe for a family life, to really spend some time and be there in his daughter as she's growing up. The one thing, though, that really kind of caught my attention with this, Zach. So you and I, we're about the same age, 27, 26, I believe. You're just a couple months older than me. So we grew up, you know, during the early aughts, like that, the early aughts, the early 2010s, that was our, you know, adolescence watching the sport. And for Hendrick Motorsports, there was the big three and then plus the other team. The big three had the crew chiefs, Steve Letarte, Alan Gustafson, Chad Knauss. Those three drivers were so ingrained into Hendrick Motorsports for a majority of us watching the sport. And now two of them are happily retired. That just leaves Alan Gustafson, who shows no signs of slowing down as he's just racking up the wins now with Chase Elliott left and right. And so for me, it just really shows like a true changing of the guard. And just really just shows how much time has actually passed for me watching this sport. And I don't like that. It's a very introspective look that I was not prepared for. You know, that's life. We all have to deal with it, I guess.
You're just like, no, you can't leave. No, you gotta stay. No, I get that. I understand. That's something I hadn't thought about till you just said it. You know, we have these massive names because that's what they are. They're incredible names, and they're championship winners too. For the most part, Steve Letarte not being one of them, but he is a multi, you know, he has won the Daytona 500 and won other incredible races. Back on all of what, you know, Chad has done for racing and what all those guys have done, and it's an incredible thing. And the changing of the guard is something that, you know, we will have to see because we love, you know, we love racing. We love to see what they're wanting to do moving forward. I think about, you know, Jeff Gordon, because he was kind of like the first big guy to leave Hendrick's, you know, on a full-time basis. And you think back to him and, you know, the big farewell he had and the impact that all the teams had on him, it made sense. And it was something that he, even though he was leaving, the sport from competition full time, he was still staying in it. He was still at Fox doing broadcasts, and then, you know, subbing for Dale Jr. the following year when he got his concussion. And then now we have Jimmy Johnson, and we have a junior, Dale Jr., who, you know, left or retired full time, but does broadcasting for NBC and does his podcast and does all this other stuff. And now we have Jimmy Johnson, who's leaving, but he won't be leaving us forever, forever. He'll be leaving us to go do whatever he wants, whether it's broadcasting or racing IndyCar, which he has signed a 2-year deal with. And his crew chief is doing the same thing. He's not leaving forever. He's still going to be at the in the sport. He'll be broadcasting, like you said, probably. But it's just going to be weird not seeing Chad Knaus on top of a pit box to, you know, make crazy calls or to go for the win. So I love it, and I truly am happy for both of those guys, especially Chad with what he's been able to do with William, because William has improved quite a bit. But it's just weird to see a changing of the guard. We got three young bucks, and then we don't know who the new guy is going to be.
We don't know who the new guy is going to be. There's a lot of rumors, a lot of speculation. The most intriguing of which being obviously the Kyle Larson rumors, only getting more and more momentum and steam by apparently a supposed meeting between NASCAR, Larson, and Chevrolet. The only nature of that meeting could possibly be about a possible reinstatement and the step-by-step process of what that would entail. So that's pretty much led most people to be fully convinced that that is who Hendrick is trying to tap to replace Jimmy Johnson. I still am waiting to see the proof in the pudding, but then again,
ooh, pudding.
I know, right? But then again, our silly season, it's still completely wide open. We don't know who's going to take the Spire cars. We don't know who's going to take the 48, the 43, for that matter, who's going to fill that ride, whether or not there's going to be a 96 Gaunt Brothers machine. There's still a lot of debate and speculation about whether that team's going to continue. Go Fast still has to fill their number 32. So there's still plenty of dominoes left to fall. So it'd be really interesting to see where they all land.
That is one of those crazy things you think about right now, is the fact that last year's silly season, it wasn't this hectic. We had, you know, by this time we really had about 90%, if not, you know, maybe 80% of everything figured out. Now there is still so much that we don't know. We're all looking at each other like, you know, I can only see that the drivers meeting, if they were doing a physical meeting, that drivers would be like, where are you going next season? I don't know. Where are you going? I can't say. Where are you going? I don't know. I can't say. It is just so weird to be less than, you know, 8 weeks out from the end of the season. There's so many open available seats and open available drivers. It's just like, what's going to happen?
Exactly. No, I'll be interested to see where this all falls and interested to see, you know, which drivers will benefit from it. I already feel like some of the moves we've already heard and some of the different swaps we've had already be announced are definitely going to help the parties involved, and everyone's going to hopefully turn out a winner in those situations. And I just keep hoping that we're going to get more great announcements like that that'll continue to help bolster some teams and organizations to put them in good positions going forward.
Yeah. I can't wait for silly season to be over, but that just leaves, you know, racing action. And I don't know if there's any other news we need to talk about. I can't think of any.
None that really come to mind, so I feel like we got some racing in Sin City to kind of catch the folks up on today.
You know, Viva Las Vegas, a track that is near and dear to my heart. It was the first track I ever attended a race back in 2004. I was just 10 years old. I was like, oh, look, it's a racetrack. And by golly, we got an action-packed weekend. Before we start the truck series, you know, big congratulations to, you know, the young lady who won the ARCA. So was it the ARCA West Series, I take it?
Yeah, I think it was the ARCA West Series, because that was the one that Haley Deegan was in last year, wasn't it? Or she and E.
Well, no, so that's the thing about this. So it was the K and N series. That's what it was first, and then it got transitioned to ARCA, and there's been a couple things. So I think she raced at Las Vegas at the ring where she won, I believe. I'm trying to remember that. It's just so confusing with the brand rechange, but I mean, let's see. I think she was racing in West, so we can say that for sure.
So the way I found the way to wordsmith it, because English is a made up language dressed up in a trench coat. Picture three separate languages stacked up on top of each other wearing a trench coat. That is English in a nutshell. It makes no fucking sense. But no. So it's the same series that Haley Deegan won in, the old pro series, but it's the first racing event sanctioned by ARCA, because that's the huge difference here, is that NASCAR no longer sanctions the East and West. They brought ARCA in under their umbrella, and now ARCA handles the sanctioning on the East and West series. And so this marks the first time an ARCA-sanctioned event was won by a female. Not the ARCA Racing Series, but an ARCA-sanctioned event. How's that for wordsmithing?
Oh, Jesus Christ. I need a beer. So Gracie Trotter won her first ever race in the ARCA-sanctioned Taco Bell. She just won, and she kicked ass, I must say.
Oh, yeah, no, and what a statement that makes for the Drive for Diversity program. NASCAR has really, you know, put a lot of emphasis into that to try and bring some different faces into the sport, bring some more recognition, because for the modern fan, it's important to have the diversity, not, you know, to fit check some PC ballot or, you know, make sure that we're conforming to societal standards. It's important because if we want to attract, you know, more fans to the sport, that fan has to feel like they are represented by the drivers that they're out there watching. A fan wants to sit down in the sport and be like, hey, that guy reminds me of me, or that girl reminds me of me. They can do it. Why can't I? I want to watch the sport because I love the sport, and maybe I want to become a driver too. And by having that diversity and having that inclusion, that really helps broaden our base and helps our reach, because we're able to reach out to so many more people. And just think for a parent, you know, if you got a little girl out there, how awesome is it to tell that little girl that not only can she do anything, she could race a big, burly stock car just like all the boys can and win too, and then point proudly to a lady like Haley Deegan who won last year, or Gracie Trotter who's won this year. And that these little victories, they're going to keep on piling up. We're going to keep on making these milestone markers, these little benchmarks, and that line's going to keep getting pushed further and further to the point where we won't be talking about Gracie Trotter for her being a female winner. We're going to talk about Gracie Trotter for her being a kick-ass NASCAR driver, you know, and that's the future we all want for. We don't want to have to always talk about, you know, identity politics when, you know, in our events, in our media or anything. And the only way we can get past having to bring up
Brady, you're wrong. All the politicians talk about identity politics, so why shouldn't we? Sorry.
Oh, no.
Okay, never mind. Back to you, Brady.
he raises a valid point. So not just in our media, but also our politicians bring up the identity politics. And the only way we can, you know, stop talking about identity politics is make sure that we're all equally represented. And it's going to suck for a few years, but that's just the growing pain. And I'm so glad, you know, that it started, you know, right around 2010 for me, you know, during that adolescence period that I was talking about with Zach here just a little bit ago with Danica Patrick, you know, breaking into sport. And then just a few years later, you know, not major accomplishments, but just little wins, you know, a top five in the Xfinity Series here, top tens there, a pole position at the Daytona 500 there, pole positions a couple places there. Nothing super flashy, but huge in the scope of things, because what did that do? That knocked down the next domino. Driver like Natalie Decker got in. Nothing super flashy, but some solid ARC results in 2017 brought some more recognition there. And then Haley Deegan came in 2018, picked up a win in the K&N Series, backed it up with a couple more wins last year. And now Gracie Trotter just continuing on. It's just another domino after domino. And we've seen this on the other side of things with more racial diversity. It started with, you know, smaller wins, you know, like getting Kyle Larson through, an Asian-American driver. Then we got Bubba Wallace through. And Ryan Vargas now, he's got a major deal with TikTok in the Sportsman Series. Daniel Suarez, the list going on and on. Just these little victories that are just compiling on each other that are really helping the sport become super healthy, super appealing to a much broader array of people. And to me, that's exciting. There's going to be so many more people out there that I can proudly, you know, wear a Richard Petty t-shirt or a Dale Earnhardt hat and be stopped in the mall, be like, hey, you're an Earnhardt fan too? Fuck yeah. And then talk, you know, a whole hour to some random stranger about NASCAR, because that's how I met you. And that's how I've met so many, you know, great friends in my life, is just meeting some of the most genuine people I can at a track. And the thought of bringing more people to that track and being able to share this sport with the broader country as a whole, that's exciting to me.
Oh yeah, for sure. Excuse me. And to put in perspective, it wasn't just like a last lap thing. Gracie actually led quite a few laps. She led 19, lead changed then 60, lead changed then 16. She led over half the race, so she definitely had some drive behind her. By the way, she is contending for a championship. She is third, 31 points out, and that's not a whole lot of points, but if they're still being – I believe it's three races left. If she can get three more races left, if she can get those runs good, if she get three good runs, she could definitely win the championship.
Oh, for real. Like that's nothing in a NASCAR race, especially in that Canaan, the Canaan, there I go again, that ARCA Menards West series. It's a very, very competitive series, and anything can happen. So, you know, just one bad race from her competitors, she's right in the thick of things a couple points out. So I'll be interested to see how she handles the last bit of her campaign, and who knows? One win's in the books. Maybe this opens the door for the floodgates to open, and she picks off a couple more before the season's over.
For sure. So after that, though, we did have the K&N Campiel. We can't get away from it. The Gander Outdoor Series trucks run at Viva Las Vegas. And by the way, one surprise driver that I kind of said pretty quick was Travis Pastrana. He was back in the truck for Nice Motorsports of Las Vegas. He loves that track, finishing 21st for another time out this year, for a second time out. And not bad for him, but also a really weird thing happened. Natalie Decker was not allowed to start the race because of medical issues. But we still haven't heard anything about that. At least I hadn't seen anything.
No, it's been very quiet on that. I know the last update I saw was right around, I believe it was Monday or maybe it was Sunday evening, where she said she was going back home to see some of her normal doctors and they were going to run some tests. But they've been very cagey on the details. So we definitely have her in our thoughts and hope she's okay and that she'll be healthy here soon. But it makes you kind of wonder if it would be something akin to like a Brian Bicker situation where this might put a hamper on her racing career going forward.
Yeah, so the last thing that's been updated on her Twitter, at least, I know you are wondering what happened and what is going on. We are boarding soon to go back home where there will be more test runs so they can further evaluate and diagnose. I will let you know as soon as that is complete. Thank you for your prayers and support, which is kind of odd, you know, with everything that's going on. She did have some issues earlier this year and last year with some medical issues where she was sidelined, and possibly, you know, this year with the coronavirus, if you have even a fever, NASCAR will pull you immediately. I know there's been crew guys and, you know, just regular, you know, workers have been pulled just for having a fever coming to the track. They may not have had any other symptoms or been in contact, but just because they had a fever, they were pulled from the track immediately. So who knows what this could be? It's not the first time she's had medical issues, so it's definitely not something we're fully aware of, but, you know, hopefully she makes a speedy recovery, and hopefully she'll be at the track next week, Talladega.
And that's kind of what I was getting at with the Brian Bickers comparison, is that this isn't the first time we've seen her have to step away due to
medical reasons, the last time of which that I can recall being in 2018 when she had to miss a couple ARCA events. The only reason I recollect that was because it gave my driver, Brennan Poole, a couple races there in 18 after he got let go from Ganassi. So that was kind of a win situation for me, but definitely not what we wanted to see for Natalie Decker. So I'm interested to see if we get more details on that as we get closer and closer to the Talladega race weekend. A race, if I'm not mistaken, she was on the entry list for originally, correct?
I believe so. That might have changed, though. I'll check real quick.
But anyway, while he's checking in on that, yes, we had the Vegas 200. I don't know what it's actually called. I've been so wrapped up in my my Lego page where I don't give any sponsor plugs. So I
have it for you if you'd like it.
Yeah, I remember. I know the other two, but I can't remember the truck one. What was the truck sponsor?
The 2020 World of Westgate 200.
That's what it was, Westgate. So Westgate, not to confuse you with Watergate, Westgate 200. It was great. We had Austin Hill performing the Vegas hat trick. He repeated his performance there from a year ago to become the only driver in the championship playoffs to safely advance his way on into the round of eight ahead of the daunting Talladega Super Speedway coming up this upcoming weekend. And Austin Hill ran a great race. He led most of the laps. Really was kind of in a league all of his own. It seemed like there for a while the GMS trucks had a lot of speed and were trying to keep pace with them. I thought at one point guys like Sheldon Creed, Brett Moffitt, Creed ended up actually sweeping both stages. Even Zane Smith was up there. I thought those three drivers would maybe be able to maybe do something. But in the end, those GMS Chevys were no match for the Hattori Racing Toyota. And the 16 team kind of put a spanking on them there. But though, while those drivers were having some great time out front, you know, really trying to rack up the points and put themselves in the best position possible heading into Talladega, one of the drivers who I thought coming into the chase looked to be one of the favorites after some late season good runs and even his win there a couple weeks ago. But Ben Rhodes, he definitely had a dismal night Friday night. Started off where he was having some power steering issues early on in the event. I believe it was right around stage one when he was having those issues. Then eventually he got turned and got put backwards into the inside wall. When he came down on pit road to get the damage fixed, some of the flat tire got wrapped around his brake rotor in the front, caught his right front brake rotor on fire. It was just a disaster of an event. And he went from being safely above the cut line to now 9 points out. Him and Todd Gilliland find themselves below the cut line. Ben Rhodes is 6 points out. I just did my post on this. Rhodes is 6 points out, and Todd Gilliland, the other driver below the cut line, he is 19 points back. So those are the drivers most in danger. Those are the drivers definitely going to be hoping to maybe sneak their way forward for a win this next weekend. But other drivers, you know, they can't be safe either. The highest driver above the cut line right now is Sheldon Creed, 52 points up, but even he's not safe. One bad wreck and no stage points, and he could find himself having his dominant season go away in a flash in one of those infamous Talladega big wrecks. So a lot of excitement there, but that was kind of my major takeaways from the Vegas race. It was kind of a very by-the-standards truck race on a mile and a half. Vegas always super entertaining for that series. Definitely trucks by far the best race of the weekend, but nothing really super spectacular, though, that stands out in my mind. How about you, Zach, on that Westgate 200?
Well, to me, it's always a good race because, like I said, I love the trucks and I love the Vegas Motor Speedway. And a big thing that you brought up was GMS. GMS is actually the Gallagher's own Allegiant, and like one of their biggest hotspots is the Vegas Las Vegas airport. So for them to bring power and to be dominant, there is no surprise because they always want to win at their quote-unquote home track. But the domination kind of fell later on, like you said, and it was kind of odd. But when we look at all three of these races this weekend, they all went from day to night. They went from really hot temperature to really cool temperature in the desert, which a lot of people don't understand how cold it actually gets there. Even this time of year, a lot of people think it's really hot. It is during the day, but the moment that the sun sets, the temperature, especially out there in the actual desert where the track is, drops almost 20 to 30 more degrees. So it kind of helps with performance, but also it throws some monkey wrenches in if you're not having the truck set up. I really enjoyed the race. It was something, again, that as someone who's watching it to see what all could happen, watching the points, watching stuff like Ben Rhodes having issues, which, again, it's kind of weird to see Thor Sports having issues again. Last week at or last race at Bristol, it was Grant Infinger who had several issues, and he bounced back to a sixth place finish this week with no real issues. So it's kind of weird to see, Thor Sport normally doesn't have these issues. If they do, it's kind of like with one truck. Maybe it's a gremlin in that chassis or in that motor or something. But to see it spread to a teammate who is in the championship contending, it's kind of weird. But one driver I want to highlight real quick is Tanner Gray. Tanner, who is racing for David Gilliland Racing, where has he come from the past few races? Because he's been crazy good. If you don't know who Tanner Gray is, he's actually a dragster. He did drag racing for Pro Stock, and quite honestly, he won a championship. He won a Wally, and this year alone, his stats have been gotten better, and especially the past few races, he has two top fives, three top tens. He doesn't have a pole this year, but also qualifying has been canceled essentially. And his average start is 8.8, and his average finish, which has actually gone down in a good way, because it was earlier this year, I believe only three or four races ago, it was like 15th. Now it's down to a 10th, which is incredible to see. This kid who went from just doing quarter mile drag racing to ovals has improved quite a bit, to the point where I think by the end of the year, he'll probably have a win.
And honestly, this was what Tanner Gray needed to do. I know he had a lot of expectations. He brought in a lot of flash with his few starts he made last year and his few starts he made in the ARCA series, but he was just so green to asphalt oval racing that I didn't have a lot of expectations, as far as wins, making the playoffs for him. The only thing I wanted to see Tanner Gray do is improve, rack up that confidence, start small, start with top 20s, eventually get to the top 15s, work your way to the top 10s. At that point, then you can start working on the top 5s, and he's done just that. And you see the tracks that he's coming back to for the second time, that's where I'm seeing a lot of the improvement. That's where he's starting to really get his confidence, because he's got his bearings there. He's run the track a few times. He kind of knows his lines, and that's where he can really put his raw, natural talent on full display. And he's not driving some subpar equipment either. For being a relatively new team and one of the very few Ford teams out there, David Gilliland has done himself a hell of a job in building a truck series operation. We saw it last year. Just the little flashes of brilliance with Ross Chastain and what he could do with those with that equipment. Not Ross Chastain. Who am I thinking of? With Tyler Ankrum, excuse me.
Yep.
And what he was able to do last year with that equipment, winning a race, winning a playoff berth. This year we saw that performance slip just a bit as they're adapting to the new Fords. But I think they're really settling in nicely. I think they've got a good foundation now. They've worked on these trucks long enough. I think that strong partnership that they're forming with a former employer of Gilliland's, Front Row Motorsports, has helped. Front Row now fielding a truck, I think, has definitely helped that communication and that technical alliance there. And we're starting to see the dividends pay out. And Gray as a driver, I think he'll just get more confident. I'd like to see him run at least, two more years in the trucks. I understand, money talks, bullshit walks, may only be one more season, but I'm really encouraged by what I've seen out of him lately. Ford's definitely got to be pleased. He's definitely one of their top budding prospects, as some of their more senior drivers are entering into the twilight phases of their career, and there's not a whole lot of drivers in waiting in the Xfinity pipeline, because that program is pretty much all and dried up. So I definitely got to like what he's putting up to get up there, and he's not alone there in that top five. Another driver we got to take a look there is Chandler Smith, another young driver who's kind of in Tanner Gray's shoes, where Tanner Gray was just a year ago. Smith, we've seen him only in a handful of races this year, where his age has allowed him to run and where he's been getting the sponsorship to do so. And we've seen the flashes of brilliance, similar to what we've seen with Tanner, but we've just not seen the full package. While he's had good races and run up front, he's crashed. He's had parts failures. He's had pit issues. And it was finally rewarding to see that 51 put together the full package, just like Tanner Gray's been able to do these last few weeks, and get a strong top five. And I didn't know if you had picked up on that or had any comments on that either, Zach.
I think Chandler definitely is, again, one of these drivers that I don't want to say he came out of nowhere because he was obviously doing fairly well for himself in the ARCA series. He still is. But the fact that he's able to perform this well with kind of an expectation that I had for him was he's more focused on the ARCA stuff because that's what he's hoping to win a championship in. Didn't see him honestly running this well because of that, because of, you know, multiple things in the ARCA series. They're getting practice, and this he is not. So it's crazy to see, but it's great to see as well his performance on how well he is. And honestly, he's proven himself to be like, hey, I'm going to be out there. I'm going to come race, and I'm not going to be someone that, you know, and next year if he runs a truck full-time, hey, you're not going to have to worry about me being a rookie because I'm going to come out there and whoop some butt. And it's showing. Now, possibly, again, he could be a driver we see at the end of the year get a win, if not come very close.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, and I want to stress this because I feel like it's being lost. And I sound like a broken record if you listen to our podcast, but it's really unprecedented what these rookies are going through in all three national series, not having to practice. That has been such a staple of the stock car auto racing leagues, all leagues, since the very inception. Practice, especially stupid long practice sessions, has been such a bedrock of the sport that not having it is having such a vast effect on the preparation for race week and especially for these younger drivers. And I feel like it's being kind of lost as we've kind of settled into this new semi-normal way of doing things, this new semi-normalcy of living in the post-COVID times. And I just want to make sure people, at least our listeners, know that it's really a huge undertaking what these rookies have been doing lately. And I am just continually impressed by the top five, the top ten, that all three series rookies and all three national touring divisions have been able to do. And I just want to make sure that, you know, like I said, I've been beating that drum a lot this year, but you really cannot overstate just how truly impressive an accomplishment this is, that their first and only laps on a track sometimes, and especially in the truck series, is in race condition, which is goes against everything these drivers have grown up doing in every form of division of racing across this country. They've done it with at least some sort of practice. In the dirt tracks, we hot lap. That's practicing. I don't care what you call it. It's fucking practice. It's hot laps. So some form of like on-track activity before there's money on the line. And so I've really just got to tip my hat to these rookies.
Tip it and tip it well, because it is much needed for their appreciation. Going down the run line, by the way, two interesting drivers, again, Travis Pastrana, but also Connor Daly, IndyCar driver coming out to do a start at Las Vegas. Always interesting to see. And Dale Lupton, who we haven't seen run very often, coming out and running for David Gilliland Racing. Great to see him back. So going through the rundown, Austin Hill, your winner yet again this season, and securing a spot into the next round. Sheldon Creed, Tanner Gregg, Stuart Friesen, Chandler Smith is your top five. Grant Infinger, Zane Smith, Christian Eckens, Matt Crafton, and Tyler Ankrum is your top 10. Johnny Sauter, Ryan Truex making one of his last few starts. Todd Gilliland, Dave Dylan Lupton, and Brett Moffitt finishing in the top 15. Tate Fogelman, Tyler Hill, Connor Daly, Spencer Davis, and Rafael Lazard, your top 20. Travis Pastrana, Clay Greenfield, Ben Rhodes, Austin Hill, Danny Bowe, and Ray Silico is your top 26. Chase Prudhee, Spencer Boyd, Josh Rayum, and Derek Krause, your top 30. Jesse Wuji, Jordan Anderson, Tim Views, Jennifer Jo Cobb, Dawson Craw, and Natalie Decker is your last 36.
One thing, before we go moving on into the Xfinity race, I guess I just now noticed it. It really makes me laugh looking at the back half of this field here, that Ray Cicerelli, after making such a stink and such a fuss over the Confederate flag being banned from NASCAR and about how I'm going to pull my support, not going to run any teams, he expanded. He was a one-car operation at that time, and now he's fielding two trucks. And I just
it makes me laugh, you know. I got to get a giggle out of that. But regardless, the ALSCO 300 awaits us, gentlemen. Las Vegas Xfinity Series excitement. And, it really throws me off that the playoffs aren't the same number of races for the three touring divisions because, you know, I've gotten all through my playoff opener hype for the Cup Series 2 weeks ago. Truck Series last week, I was like, all right, Xfinity Series, oh, shit. It's their playoff opener. They haven't done this yet. So it was the all-important first race in the playoffs. And I got to say, a lot of very important things came out of this event. Some definite big names had some great nights, and some very big names also stumbled. Zach, what were some of your takeaways from the ALSCO 300?
Ryan Sieg needs to either get better equipment or get an opportunity from RCR or one of these other places, because honestly, with what he did, being second for a majority of the race, you know, yeah, he didn't finish second in the stages, but seeing him every time I checked, because I was busy doing stuff, every time I checked, he was second in this field with Chase Briscoe leading. Holy hell. Ryan Sieg, we've talked about before, he's an incredible racer and, you know, owns his own team and has had some ups and downs, but Vegas, for some reason, as well as tracks, either he clicked with really well or he bought something that he knew he was going to be able to perform well. He finished fifth, and seeing that, I'm in awe shock. And, you know, looking at the points for him, he's to the good right now. And, you know, that's not saying a whole lot, but seeing him in the good to go for now is crazy. To advance to the next round, I should say.
Well, and the other thing that was really neat that was pointed out in the broadcast was the reason why he was running so well, because it's the same team he drives for every week. It's his own family-owned equipment, his own family-prepped car. But what made this car so special and why he was able to flex so much muscle is this was one of those rare opportunities where they had the sponsorship money, they had the budget to do so. They purchased a car or a chassis from, I believe it was either a chassis or a full car. I couldn't quite get that from the broadcast, but they purchased it from Richard Childress. So he was basically running an RCR car just prepped by his family team. And what a difference the equipment has made. Zach is completely correct. If this man does not get either more money into his family-owned team that they can afford better equipment week in, week out, or get a ride from a better, you know, well-established team, it would be the biggest mistake in NASCAR history because he has got so much untapped talent. He's a veteran of the sport. He's been around in the Truck Series and the Xfinity Series. He takes care of equipment, which is super, super important, especially in these cost-efficient days, especially post-COVID. He knows how to maximize and get the most out of his equipment. We've seen it with the multiple top tens he's been able to do and just how he constantly outperforms and overperforms the extent of his equipment and what that car should be able to provide him. We've seen it with Ross Chastain. I feel like Ryan Sieg is being looked over too much for what he can provide a bigger team. And who knows? We might be talking out of our ass right now, Zach. He could be extremely happy, and this could be exactly how he wants to find success in the sport. It could be more important to him that, you know, he becomes like a Wood Brothers or a Petty's, where if he's going to do it and he's going to win races and championships, he's going to do it with the people he's running by his side. And I hope that if that's the direction he wants to do, they have shown that if given the right equipment, they have the same wherewithal as any of those big teams, that they can put a competitive car on the track. And I want to see it happen. CMR Roofing, that car looks beautiful. They stepped up their sponsorship in a big way. They are throwing the money that team needs to be competitive at them, and I hope that relationship continues. Sounds like they inked a deal for 2021. I'm hyped for that. Ryan Sieg, 2021, baby. Let's get him some better cars. I feel like he's going to get a good run in the playoffs. He's not dead yet, and the reason why they shelled out the extra cash is they knew Vegas was such a pivotal race. With the next two races in their round being Talladega and the Roval, they needed to either win or have as much points as they possibly could, and they fucking did it. Fourth in stage one, fifth in stage two, fifth in stage three. Ryan Sieg, baby.
You can see the burning passion that Brady has. But, yeah, Ryan, and, you know, just going over some of his stats throughout the years, because he hasn't won ever in a NASCAR event, anything from the Cup Series. He's ran some Cup races. Nationwide, he's ran full-time essentially since 2014 with his family-owned team. He's ran, quite a few in the Truck Series. Never got a top five in the trucks. Now, just this season alone, he's doubled his top five finishes. He had one in 2014, one in 2016, one in 2017, and two in 2019. He's doubled that in just this one season. His average finish, even though it doesn't look that good, 15th, you look at him and you think, well, 15th, how's he running so well? Honestly, it's that kind of consistency for the smaller budget team. It's one of those things where I've said this quite a few times. Consistency is the key to winning, not races, but championships. You know, this year alone, he has, he's had some mediocre stuff, some wrecks and stuff, but honestly, most of his stuff is in the top 20, if not the top 15 throughout the year. But it's crazy to see and crazy to think what he's capable of. And just a quick thing, last year's race, he actually got disqualified. His car was deemed illegal somehow. I can't remember how, but he was credited for last place finish. So kind of a redeeming factor for himself this year.
And the other thing you got to keep in mind with that whole organization, is I don't know where I was going with that, honestly. It was something about the mediocrity, and I got distracted by that. So, yeah.
You saw Cookie.
Now, Brady,
you saw Cookie.
Stop getting distracted.
I know, right? Shiny object. But no, hell of a run by Ryan. And like I said earlier, it was a very pivotal race, and he was not the only one that racked up some valuable stage points. Noah Gregson had a good run. Justin Allgaier, Austin Cindric, Michael Annette, Harrison Burton, and Haley, all those drivers in the playoff, they all had solid top 10 runs. Some of them, maybe didn't have quite as good runs they wanted to or get the stage points and stage finishes as they needed to because Talladega, anything can happen there. As we were looking through, kind of a breakdown of the event, not a whole lot of incidents to report. A couple of minor spins, the 61 spun off of turn two. Oh, the odd accident, honestly, of the night was the very first incident on lap 9, the 47. Is that still Weatherman? Is he still driving that car? Yeah, Kyle Weatherman.
Yes.
He went for a loop coming off the front stretch, and he kind of came to a stop right in front of the exit in the wall that the pace car usually jumps out of. And so the pace car kind of had to just chill there until they could get his car moved because his car was kind of dead. And I don't know, to me it just kind of created just a humorous little snapshot in the race, the poor trapped pace car. But other than that, we had debris.
I was going to ask, do you know why he spun out like that?
I can't say that I do, because I think during that race I was with friends, so I could only watch it on my phone, so I didn't have the actual sound going.
Well, they didn't really say himself, but actually he posted it later online that his steering shaft actually fell apart or fell out. It's been a couple of days since, but it just essentially fell out. And the only way to save the car from not getting destroyed was hopefully crank the wheel that something caught and that he would, spin it out. So it was an odd one because of that. He wasn't trying to per se crash. But it was so weird to see and then to read that. I was like, holy cow, that's crazy.
Oh, that event was more bizarre than that. I just thought it was bizarre because the cute, candid moment of the trap pace car was humorous to me. I guess I didn't know anything nefarious afoot, but alas.
Alas. Hey, my lady.
My lord.
My lord.
Oh, yeah.
My lady.
We're no longer the Charlotte line. We are the Downton Abbey line, I guess, the Sharp Apex line. The Sharp Apex line.
Sharpay. So run down the order, just Chase Briscoe getting another win, eighth of the season.
He got his eighth.
Yeah, two more and he can get 10. I did math. Wow. No, Greg.
That's great. That's great. 8 + 2 = 10. I'm proud of you.
American education system hasn't failed Zach yet. We've got it, folks.
Yeah. Daniel Hemrick getting a great run for himself, finishing third. Justin Allgaier, Ryan Sees, are top five. Austin Cindric, Michael Annette, Anthony Alfredo, Harrison Burton, Justin Haley, your top 10. Brandon Jones, Riley Herbst, Jeremy Clemens, Brett Moffitt, and Brandon Brown, your top 15. Ross Chastain, Austin Hill, Josh Williams, Matt Schneider, Stephen Parsons, your top 20. Caleb Holman, Tommy Joe Martin, Jesse Little, Greg Golding, Bailey Curley, top 25. BJ McLeod, Joe Graff Jr., Timmy Hill, Dexter Bean, and Matt Millish, your top 30. Cody Vandeweer, Alex LeBay, Jeffrey Earnhardt, Vinny Miller, Chad Fincham, your top 35, and 36, Kyle Weatherman.
Oh, yes. No, it was an interesting deal. But with that, Chase Briscoe, 8 wins in hand. He did what he came out for, and now he's safe and sound into the next round of the playoffs, the round of 8 for the Xfinity Series, which is crucial as they'll be heading to some very tricky track in the next couple weeks. But with that, we go on to the main event, the Cup Series, the South Point Casino 400. And honestly, this is the most excited I think I've ever been to talk about a Cup Series race at Las Vegas. Holy crap. It was a by-the-numbers event. And then the caution came. The caution to end all cautions. It flew at the most pivotal time, and we got ourselves a race, boys. Zach, walk us through it. What did we see here?
First off, NASCAR, what the fuck are you thinking starting a race this late for the East Coast? I'm still baffled by this because this is something I never got to really talk about. The fact of the matter is this race started so late on Sunday on this side of the country. Like, what? A lot of people over here who are diehard NASCAR fans, I talked to a bunch of them, they didn't watch the race. They watched, like, the first 100 laps, and then they went to bed because they had to work in the morning. So NASCAR, if you want to do a night race, I love the idea. I love the concept. Let's do it in Vegas for the backdrop for that. Do it on Saturday. Do it on Saturday. That's what it's meant to be for. We can't do night races on Sunday. The only time we can, Memorial Day and Labor Day. You know why? Because we're off those days. So fix that. But this race, up until about lap 250, it was kind of normal, you know, competition, caution, stage ends, a couple degrees here and there. But then we got the God's honest, you know, cautions. It was like, holy crap, what is going on? And that last caution to bring out the start finish line or the green white checkered and the honest battle, I thought Matthew Benedetto, I thought he had the race won. If he could get that restart really good, he had a good one, but Kurt Busch just outdid him to get his first ever career win at Las Vegas Motor Speedway, his home track. And holy cow, was that – I mean, that last two laps, honestly, kind of just shows what kind of battle you have with a Busch brother at Vegas. And by the way, if your last name's Busch, you had a great weekend. Brexton won a race. Kurt won a race. All right, maybe not all Bushes had a great weekend, but it was still a great race weekend for the Busch family.
And honestly, I love this win. Just like his win last year at Kentucky, you got to see the full display, the full extent of the talent that netted Kurt Busch a championship at such a young age and at such an inexperienced level in his career. To me, even though Kyle arguably has the better statistics behind him, I honestly think the more raw talent belongs with the elder Busch brother. I think that Kurt has the more natural ability and just the technical aspect, I think, is what gives me, in my opinion, the backing to stand on to make that claim, because Kurt has such a knowledge about the car and how the car operates from a technical aspect, and he provides such good mechanical feedback. And if you look at where he's gone throughout his career, he's bounced a lot. And the reason, you know, to do that is his temper. And I think his temper definitely kept him from achieving the heights that his younger brother has achieved. But everywhere that Kurt has gone, he has made that organization better
before having him on the team. You know, you look at Roush Fenway. They won their first championship the year before with Matt Kenseth, but he brought so much exuberance, so much, you know, vibrance to that team once he got the fire going and once he started rattling off wins in 02, that it really helped that organization, you know, become the kind of behemoth it became there in the middle 2000s. And, you know, it kind of unceremoniously not looked at and really overshadowed during that time. A lot of people point to Mark Martin leaving the team in 06 as to why Roush kind of fell on some harder times and kind of slowly degraded. But I honestly think them losing Kurt Busch probably hurt them more because they didn't have, you know, that kind of Mark Martin level of mechanical feedback that they could build on and rely on going forward like they had done with Mark in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of the first place I look. Penske definitely was kind of in a lost place after Rusty Wallace. Ryan Newman was good but was super inconsistent and could not lead that team. And he kind of really helped lay the groundwork for Brad Keselowski to settle into that position and make Penske the organization that it is today. Then you look at, you know, Furniture Row Racing, his 1 year there, and a couple of years later, the organization went from being, you know, a mid-pack team before he got there to being a championship-winning team just a few years after his 1 year with the team. And then Stuart Haas, you know, he really helped elevate what was the 39 program run by Ryan Newman, turned that into a perennial championship-contending team, made several round of eight appearances, won several races, won the Daytona 100, and really helped bolster that program before leaving it. And that team has not been the same since he left. And then now we're at his current ride with the number one Chevrolet. McMurray was a great driver. And honestly, it still baffles me today. He's honestly one of the most curious cases of the early 2000s rookies that did not have a career that panned out like I thought it would. I really thought when he set the world on fire by winning in his second ever race as a substitute for Sterling Marlin, that we were witnessing something huge, and it never caught fire. And I kind of, you know, wonder, was it the equipment? You know, and that's just a whole rabbit hole for another day. But
yeah,
so the one team was not on a good winning level, even though Kyle Larson was winning with the equipment. I just really feel like Chip Ganassi was elevated by Larson's sheer talent alone. And so Kurt Busch coming in last year, I noticed such an improvement in that whole team's operation. And I'm talking about the one specifically, about that team's operation, about its consistency. And then this year, they're just really building on it. They finally got that win that's been eluding them all season, but the consistency is still there. They've still got that all-out speed. And the Chevrolet itself is really, you know, a much more competitive car this year. So I really like what I'm seeing there. And Kurt Busch, he went from being the lowest ranked speed heading into Vegas, he was ranked 12th of the 12 drivers starting this round, to now he's the only one safe heading into the two most treacherous tracks on the circuit, the Roval and Talladega. And honestly, I'm here for it because growing up, my younger brother and I, we were super competitive. And we, you know, anytime we could play any sort of racing, whether it be video games, sledding, bikes, you name it, if we could race it, we were super competitive. And we loved the Busch brothers because we saw a lot of ourselves in them and just how, you know, just ferocious and how much they loathed losing to their younger brother. And obviously I related more to Kurt being the older of the two of me and my siblings. So I love it when Kurt can just put on such an ass-whooping performance like this, and especially when he can beat his younger brother. I point to like races like at the Richmond race in 2012 where he beat out Kyle Busch, driving Kyle's car in the Xfinity Series, to last year at Kentucky where he beat out Kyle Busch for that win, and then this year being the Busch brother to deliver the Las Vegas home trophy to their Las Vegas, you know, family members. That was just really cool for me to see, and I love it when the monster car wins. What a badass-looking racing machine. I love the monster car.
That is for sure. And the real quick stat for Kurt Busch, only four seasons – I'm sorry, I take it back – only three seasons in full-time competition In a cup car, he has not won a race. 2001, his full-time rookie year. 2012 and 2013, he never won a race. Every year other than those, he has won a race. So it's great to see that because Kurt's a great racer. He is a great guy. You know, he's had some him and his brother share some similarities when it comes to maybe the way they talk to people or some of their actions. But Kurt's definitely matured more and has changed a lot over the past ever since he got to James Finch's 51 car. That definitely changed him a lot. He still has a little bit of a temper, but not so much to where, you know, he has his rides possibly taken away. So great to see him and great to see what he's done. And, you know, Matthew Benedetto, honestly, the Cinderella shoe did not fit this time yet again. It's uncertain where he's going to go. He's spoken on Twitter, I think either today or yesterday, saying next couple days he should have something where he's going to be, but I hope soon we'll be able to see that. So the running order real quick, Kurt Busch, your winner, Matt DiBenedetto coming in second, Denny Hamlin, Martin Truex Jr., Alex Bowman, your top five, Kyle Busch, Ryan Blaney, Eric Jones, Chris Buescher, and Kevin Harvick, your top 10, Jimmy Johnson with a great run for himself finishing 11th, Clint Bowyer, Brad Keselowski, Joey Logano, and Ryan Newman, your top 15, Cole Custer, one of the highest finishing rookie, finishing 16th, Eric Almirola, Matt Kenseth, Ryan Preece, and John Hrnček, your top 20. Michael McDowell, my guy, 21st. Chase Elliott with a little bit of a bad run for himself, finishing 22nd. Ricky Stenhouse Jr., Christopher Bell, William Byron, finishing 25th. Ty Dillon, Corey LaJoie, Bubba Wallace, Daniel Suarez, and Brendan Poole, your top 30. Greg Golding, Austin Dillon, J.J. Yaley, Quinn Hoff, and Joey Gase, your top 35. Josh Bilicki, Tyler Hill, Tyler Reddick, and Chad Fincham is your top 39. Bad luck for Tyler Reddick, but still a great race. Just NASCAR, don't start the race at the – I'm not understanding why. If we're going to do a night race, it's going to be on a Sunday, though, not on a holiday. What?
I was kind of questioning that, too, because I woke up that day. I was fully expecting, like, a 2 o'clock race, and, you know, I just had to move this weekend where I've got my own room now since I'm recently single. And so I woke up Saturday morning, and I was like, all right, you know, I'm going to be a piece. Sunday morning, I'm going to be a piece of shit. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to watch racing in my bed. And then I was like, where's the race at? And then I saw 6 o'clock my time, so I guess it would have been 7 o'clock your time. I was like, well, I guess there's a lot of time between now and then. I guess I actually got to do things with my life today. So, mm-hmm. You know, I'm with you right there. I was definitely perplexed by that move by NASCAR. But, you know, I guess their thought process was, hey, football hosts events at 7 o'clock on Sunday nights and people watch them. Why can't NASCAR?
See, the big problem is the start time was, you know, 7 o'clock. And football games, when I say start time, that's when, like, you know, pre-race and stuff starts. Our race doesn't start till, I say green flag, probably 7:45, 6:45 your time. And football, when they say start time, they actually meet at that time. So I'm just like, why compete with something like that? You know, NASCAR, you know, people come home from church at noon to 1 o'clock here in the South. That's when we know NASCAR is going to be on right after that. We're going to sit down and watch the race, eat some food, and hang out. Not this time. It's like, ah, crap, I got nothing to do for 6 hours. I'm not going to watch, you know, I'm not going to watch football. I'm just going to sit here and do something, I guess. I don't know. I'm perplexed, you know. If this was our Saturday night race, I'd have no problem. Because, like, cool, you know, a majority of us are going to be up anyways doing something, and we're going to enjoy what we're going to, you know, we're going to enjoy the racing. Not this, though, you know. I'm still perplexed because there's no holiday, there's no this, there's no that, so why even do it?
I think they were just kind of, honestly, in COVID times, the only thing I can think of is why not try it, you know, see if it'll work, see how what it does for ratings, see if it's maybe something to employ for next year, because that's what a lot of this schedule's been. It's just ideas to throw out there to see, hey, would a primetime event on a Sunday night work for one of our playoff races? If not, we may not see it next year, but I mean, I feel like this at this point, they're just experimenting because all they're just looking at every way they can revamp things for that all-important 2021-2022 schedule. So I can't knock them for at least trying it to see if it would work, but I can definitely understand the frustration.
I would say that you're right, but last year they announced this race, and nothing had changed. The only thing that changed was no practice and no qualifying.
Oh, well, then, fuck me. I have no idea then.
No, I'm just letting you know because, yeah, it perplexes me that, you know, if there's a holiday, it makes sense because, yeah, Labor Day, we have the Southern 500. We have the World 600 on Memorial Day. It makes sense. But this, we don't have a, you know, holiday. It's just a day. Like, what are – I'm just
well,
so
you know what? We better save
though.
This one for next time because we're out of time, and we'll see everybody next week on the Charlotte Line.
Dega weekend.
Bye.
Going to Dega.